You're listening to New Mexico Filmworks on Talk 1260 KTRC.
You're listening to New Mexico Filmworks on Talk 1260 KTRC. I'm your host, Toby Ives, from the New Mexico State Film Office. Dirk Norris was unavailable this week. He was actually in Portales earlier on with the showcase, the New Mexico Filmmakers Showcase. We had over 37 entries of local filmmakers that were screening their films. If you're interested in upcoming screenings, you can look at our website at nmfilm.com and get the dates and towns the next ones will it'll be occurring in. Today we have Talia Kosh. Talia is with the New Mexico Lawyers for the Arts nonprofit organization. Today we're going to cover what exactly that is, and we're going to talk to Talia about the evolution and who this encompasses and addresses and the aspects of film and all sorts of great stuff, and of course the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival that's currently going on. Talia, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Toby. Thanks for having me.
Welcome. So the New Mexico Lawyers for the Arts is a non-profit dedicated to providing artists and art organizations with pro bono legal assistance and educational programming with the state of New Mexico.
Yes.
So can you tell us a little bit more about that? I mean, it sounds fantastic, and it's very broad. So tell us a little bit more about what you do.
Sure, and you know, a lot of the initial questions we get is, oh, why do artists need that? Because we're dealing with a big spectrum of artists, not only filmmakers, but visual artists, musicians, and sort of outside of those realms as well. And we have a referral network set up, and we're attempting to expand that in the next year as well, of attorneys, and not only attorneys, but also accountants. We find that artists and filmmakers do not often have the funds to provide for their own legal representation and accounting assistance, especially at the beginning of their careers or when they're just starting to get bigger, their business is starting to expand. That's especially when they need this kind of assistance, and that's usually the time when they can't afford it. So that's the pro bono aspect there is, and we really rely on attorneys in the state to work with us in that referral network. And then we also have the educational programming aspect. We try to do something once a month for artists, from copyright basics to estate planning for artists to how to protect your rights as a photographer. And then we have filmmaker summits we've had for the last 2 years, which have a variety of subjects that we deal with, from fair use to the business of production.
I also imagine that not only if you don't have the resources for this, you know, a lot of artists are, they don't want to deal with that part of it, right? And they don't know the questions to ask. And, you know, I know I'm a right and left brainer. So, you know, I get there's just sometimes it gets in the way of creativity. So it's really nice to have that help and organization to protect yourself rather than feeling overwhelmed by it, I would imagine.
It is. It's an interesting issue, especially with visual artists, is that they don't, it's kind of like there's this block to the business aspects of creation. And I find with filmmakers that doesn't occur as much. They know and are sort of poised to present themselves as a business. And so they will seek assistance from us more at the beginning, which is when we can most help people.
Right, right. So tell us a little bit about your background. Let's talk about, you know, how you became involved in this, and then eventually the evolution of this organization here in New Mexico. Because I understand there's a similar organization from Washington, D.C., and that was something that you were involved in?
Yes. There's actually VLAs, which is Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts, all over the country. The main one is in New York, and there's also – that's the largest one. That's the one that people think about when they think of VLA. California has a large one as well. And then the one that I had experience with was when I was in D.C. Getting my LLM, which is a Master's of Law, after I got my JD in New Orleans. And I called the VLA in D.C. to see if I could volunteer.
I have to interrupt you. The JD is that when you pass
the bar?
The
Juris Doctorate, yes. Okay. It's when you finish law school.
Great.
And then
sure
you pass the bar. So I passed the bar in Maryland. And I was up there looking for work, which is a really saturated market for attorneys. And so I called the VLA to see if I could volunteer on a pro bono basis to assist artists. And they had a year waiting list up there.
Wow.
For actually, they had too many attorneys. It was already saturated. And they do have less artists than New Mexico does up there. But I thought that was pretty amazing. So then when I moved back to New Mexico, no VLA existed, which is interesting because we're the third largest art market in the country. Mm-hmm. And it's so much more necessary than a lot of other states that this organization exists. I started to get involved in the nonprofit world and was really supported to found and create this nonprofit, first under a fiscal sponsor, Creative Santa Fe. And then from there, we got our own nonprofit status.
And when was that?
This was about a year ago.
Okay. So I think you were on the show when Trish Lopez was working in our office, I think. And that was probably about when you started. So what has changed?
Well, we've had a board for several years.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And under a fiscal sponsor, you still get that. Fiscal sponsorship is actually a really interesting issue for artists as well, because a lot of artists think that maybe I should think about a nonprofit and forming my own nonprofit. And you can actually, if you have a project, like a film, for example, you can pair up with a fiscal sponsor or another nonprofit and use their status instead of having to go get your own, because it's a real complicated process. There's a lot of checks and balances. You have to have your own board. And if you're just a project of a fiscal sponsor, you don't have to do any of that.
I don't think you'll qualify for our incentive, though.
There you go. Yes, no. Definitely check with the film office before you do this.
That's okay. You know, however you need to get your the point is the storyline and getting your project done, right?
Yeah, but if you're thinking about nonprofit, that's often a way to go for projects and nonprofits, state-formed nonprofits that are just starting out.
Gotcha. And so let's talk about who you cover. I mean, you broached on photographers and filmmakers, but it's basic anyone creating
nonprofit organizations as well.
Okay.
We assist them in getting their 501c3 status or pairing up with fiscal sponsors. These are really applying for nonprofit status at the federal level is a really complicated process, and you kind of have to have your ducks in a row.
So then the individuals that come to you.
And then the individuals, yes, artists of all sorts.
So you're talking art authors and photographers and...
Yes, the area, sculptors, literary areas, sculptors, visual
music,
artists.
All that, everyone.
Yes. I think the most calls we get are from visual artists and filmmakers, and especially in photographers. And, for example, about one or two a year, we get calls from artists saying, hey, I was commissioned to do this mural, or I did this mural in this public space, and now it's being covered up with advertising, or the owner is threatening to take it down, those kinds of things.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. We find those kind of areas interesting because you're dealing with sort of moral rights of artists. Even though we don't necessarily recognize that, it's covered under the Visual Artists Rights Act. So there are some things that you can do to protect your work if it's in a public space.
That's fantastic. Now, I know you were kind enough to do a presentation at our education summit back, I think it was on September 7th, down at the Hispanic Cultural Center. And you had a great presentation. And I know one of the things I find interesting, of course, is the copyright. And I have to tell this quick story. When I was in 4-H Club or Girl Scouts in fourth grade, I won the drawing contest and got my badge. So the next year we come back, and my best friend says, well, what did you draw? And I told her, and she drew it, and then she won the badge. I was, like, forever, like, paranoid. I'm a paranoid of plagiarism and copyright, and like, she stole my idea. And I imagine that's, you know, a common aspect you have to address, of course, in a very simplified young fashion, right?
But that's how it starts, and absolutely, and I think that just progresses You know, if we're looking at filmmakers, from the very beginning that they start talking about ideas with someone else and writing those down, you have created issues of joint authorship, which can come back to bite you sometimes or kill your entire project if you don't have an agreement, an understanding of what each of you is contributing to that work, and then also when you're pitching a confidentiality agreement, if you can get one.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You know, obviously our office receives a lot of scripts, and I worked at a production company in Las Vegas, Nevada, and I remember people just coming in and dropping scripts. I had piles of scripts, you know, in desperation of someone to do their project, and I couldn't believe, I mean, it wasn't even a treatment, it wasn't even a synopsis, it was literally scripts, you know, and, you know, it wasn't even like they had the watermark or the copyright info on them, and I don't know a lot about this kind of thing, but I just know that I thought, wow.
Well, and sure, and that brings that highlights the difference between an idea and something that's fixed in a tangible medium, like written down like a script. So you have ideas aren't protected by copyright, but when you have written a script down, it actually is protected by copyright, whether or not you put that little C symbol on there. Right. But you can't actually enforce that copyright until you register it.
I see. Because I would imagine, you know, what I hear, and of course this is all hearsay, is that you get people that, well, that was my idea and they tweaked it enough, so now it's not, you know, it's no longer my idea. And I imagine that's where a lot of litigation occurs if, you know, it were to evolve in that ugly fashion.
Sure, and that's where the defense of fair use comes in as well. If you transform something enough, you've created your own work, and it's actually, you're not appropriating somebody's work anymore.
Gotcha. Well, we're talking to Talia Kosh right now at the New Mexico, from the New Mexico Lawyers for the Arts, a nonprofit. And we're going to be back in just a moment. You're listening to Talk 1260 KTRC. I'm Toby Ives, and we'll be back momentarily. Welcome back. You're listening to New Mexico Filmworks on Talk 1260 KTRC. If you'd like to listen to this cast again, please feel free to go to santafe.com and go to the podcast, and you can listen to this one or any of our previous ones. We're talking to Talia Kosh, and Talia is from the New Mexico Lawyers for the Arts. Talia, we were just discussing, we're kind of getting into your code of best practices. Is that correct?
Yes, and sort of to preface that and give a basis for what that means and why that's so important. We have sort of found working with filmmakers a few things, that there's lots of confusion and misunderstanding with regard to copyright laws, contracts, work for hire, fair use in general. The list goes on. And so that, coupled with sort of the rise of accelerated technologies, has sort of left copyright law in its wake and unable to keep up with these changes in the digital era. And filmmakers don't know a lot about entity selection, and they, in addition to all of the other things I just discussed.
Let me ask you, entity selection, does that mean forming the business for the project?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, so when they form an LLC right at the beginning of their project, the word on the street is just form an LLC and it's all good. Mm. And
I know that from our incentives,
which actually is really significant, the shift in that is that, you know, it's great to be a single-member LLC in New Mexico, but not so much a multi-member LLC.
That's correct. If you have partners, multiple partners, LLC versus a, you know, C-Corp, for instance. But.
And then, you know, corporations, they have their own difficulties.
Right.
And a lot more, it's a lot more detail to figure out. So those things... filmmakers tend to just say, oh, I'll deal with all of those issues later. And by then, the problems have already arisen. So, you know, if filmmakers can make more informed choices right at the beginning and get some legal advice, get some accounting assistance, then they can, they just won't face as many potentials of litigation down the road with their
right.
work.
And I know it's like I was saying earlier, it's that if you're focused on your creativity, you go into denial about those kind of business aspects because you feel like it's going to mess with your flow, if you will.
That's right. And like, for example, there's this one filmmaker that Jeff Krulik stated, "I've not let rights issues deter me if footage is critical to a story. I had no qualms about liberally using footage that I didn't have the rights for. However, this successfully and effectively prevents me from ever selling this film to distributors. It exists on my website. I screen it at festivals. It's a proud part of my body of work, but it now sits on my shelf."
That's because he didn't get the rights to that particular footage, or the legal rights, I should say.
Clearance. Yeah, clearance rights.
And you know, we've that's come up when we've talked with people initially, like when we have our locations discussions and that kind of thing. What was one? There was one where someone was using the Rail Runner, and so to have that Rail Runner logo in that shot.
Right.
You know, if it's
going to be a significant piece of your shot, you're going to have to get a clearance for it, unless you're using the fair use defense. And
can I just ask you real quick about Jeff's quote? He can exhibit it, but not for profit. Is basically what that means.
Right. Yeah. Okay. He has to just be really careful. It's not going to be distributed because of that. And the problem with that is that, especially for documentary filmmakers, if they're doing sort of a historical film and there's a lot of film clips, they're not going to be able to afford to go get clearance and pay for the licensing fees for all of those clips. So they have to rely on fair use, which basically is it's these four factors that determine whether or not you can take something without permission and use it in your work.
Okay.
And the basic line of those four factors, it's kind of a detailed analysis that we've gone over in other panels that we've had.
Sure.
But is the work transformative? Are you using it for a different purpose?
Right.
And the best practices from the Stanford Fair Use Project out in D.C., they developed a best practices for documentary filmmakers in fair use, which actually they'll be Skyping into our summit this week and talking about this as a workshop for about an hour and a half, which is really exciting.
Do you want to tell our listeners when that occurs?
So that occurs today at 3, which will be it'll already have happened by Saturday when you hear this, but we will have a recording of it.
Fair enough. That sounds like the recording will be on your website of these panels and
it
all
will.
The videos.
Okay. It will.
And what is your website?
It's nmlawyersforthearts.org.
Oh, that's great. So that information will be available to go in detail of those four aspects of fair use.
And we're also on Facebook, and we do a lot of updates on Facebook. I think that's if filmmakers are on Facebook, and they should be.
Both for the film office, which is Film New Mexico, to plug that real quick. And what's yours?
And New Mexico Lawyers for the Arts. We have a page and we have a group as well.
Is that New Mexico spelled out or just NM Lawyers for the Arts?
It's New Mexico spelled out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, that's good because I think that, you know, if I was a filmmaker, I'd be very interested in going over that fair use.
Yeah, and basically these best practices, I mean, it sounds really dry and boring, but they've actually changed the landscape of documentary filmmaking because these are areas that a code was developed around where filmmakers can rely on using fair use and taking clips without permission in certain areas. And if they do that, they are also developing a community practice that judges look at. So you're not only are you more empowered, but mm-hmm. you're also strengthening that practice every time you use it.
And I imagine as documentaries, if you're on the spot and you have that information, you can make more informative decisions that aren't going to cost you and hopefully not cost the project, you know, in a larger scale. Like, you can keep the integrity of your mission of that documentary, if you will.
That's right, and it gives filmmakers on the spectrum more conscious choices. So if you're a filmmaker that's like, I don't care, you can rely on this and you're not going to hurt your film later. If you're a filmmaker that is afraid to use anything and you're inhibiting your creative process by not using anything, this can empower you to maybe use more fair use in your work.
That sounds great. I think when we come back, I'd like to go over a few different examples so we can, you know, if someone's walking down the street and you want a shot of this building and these people, like, where are those people? What people do you have to get photo releases from? What if there's some type of sign on the building that's behind you? When is it something you need clearance for? Maybe we could run through an example. So, Tali, if you just hold on a minute. You're listening to New Mexico Filmworks on Talk 1260 KTRC. You can always visit santafe.com to listen to this podcast again or previous podcasts. I'm Toby Ives with the New Mexico State Film Office, and we'll be back in just a moment.
The Friendship Club is dedicated to serving the recovery community in the Santa Fe area. It includes all persons seeking recovery physically, mentally, and spiritually, holding a variety of positive classes and activities where people can heal and help one another. For more information, go to santafe.com, keyword Friendship Club.
Girls Inc. inspires all girls from 5 to 18 to be strong, smart, and bold. For inspiration and more information, go to santafe.com, keyword Girls Inc.
Welcome back. You're listening to New Mexico Filmworks on Talk 1260 KTRC. I'm speaking with Talia Kosh for the New Mexico Lawyers for the Arts. Talia, again, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Toby.
I was just kind of going on in about a possible scenario I was making up about what some of these questions that you shouldn't be intimidated by or, you know, not forget about to ruin your project or to consider to keep the creativity or the integrity of your project. And I was just discussing about, you know, let's say you're on the street, you're doing this documentary, you're interviewing people, maybe you've already set up this interview, that's all set up, but now you see this great shot of a building with a sign with other people. I mean, are those the kind of things that these code of practices would help you understand?
Yes, it would. And first, before going to that, you know, we're talking about, you know, having to get clearances for location issues, which is sort of different than getting you know, copyright clearance for your film clip. So that the best practices doesn't speak to that issue. You want to be careful when you're in a neighborhood to be able to ask permission of the people in there,
right. Not the permitting process per se,
exactly.
But let's say, because I think if you're on a public street, you're fine.
If you're on a public street, you're fine. If you're filming from a place that is on public land or a sidewalk, you're fine. If you start to go into a private place, then you have some issues and you need to...
Right. And we're not talking about city and county permits. We're just talking about in regards to what you can
shoot
and
buildings. Keep. You can film buildings. You don't need any clearance for that.
For signs or anything like that?
It depends on what sign you're talking about. But say in the background there's a sign for the city. You, if it's going to be somehow featured in your film, or you know, it's some sort of, it's not just.
You need to double check with that entity.
Through. You need to double check with them and try to get that permission.
And if all else fails, get photo releases if you don't know. I mean, those kind of things.
Yeah, if you can get permission, you should try. Because that goes to your defense as well. If you've actually attempted to get the permission and you've been denied, then that strengthens your fair use argument.
Okay, so that's where it goes into fair use and then segues into your best practices because you're talking about what ends up in the film itself.
That's right. So, for example, if there's some sort of trademarked logo that just happens to be in the back of what you're filming and it's not a featured piece of your film, then you might be able to get away with it as long as you're not defaming that in any way or making or bringing attention to it,
right.
Then you're going to be okay.
Right. And so that's where you see now, like in all the reality shows, if they haven't gotten clearance, they do the little fuzzy t-shirts and the fuzzy caps, you know?
That's right.
I guess it depends if you like that or not.
Right. And if the person's identifiable, you need to get a release for them.
So they have some type of celebrity status, in other words, then that adds another layer.
But if you're on a public street, I mean, you can film. You can film there. People don't have a right of privacy on a public street.
Oh, that's great. So let's talk a little bit more about your code of best practices and your digital natives and those good things.
And then also, if you want to go to the Stanford Fair Use Project website, they have, after developing the code of best practices for documentary filmmaking, they developed several other codes of best practices, one for fair use and online videos. So that's for people who may not even be artists or filmmakers that can really rely on, yeah.
So that's the centerforsocialmedia.org?
Centerforsocialmedia.org. And then another one for educators.
So like for the universities teaching media programs and that
right.
kind of thing?
There's a lot of confusion that comes out of that, actually. That's part of what's very problematic about there not being enough copyright education in our educational system in general, and specifically with digital natives or youth who want to get into the arts, because teachers don't really understand it more than sort of this basic overview. But there's so many nuances that are really important to
So educators just could go to ARL.org, which stands for Association of Research Libraries, for instance, as well as Center for Social Media, as we've talked about, and the PIJIP-impact.org. Then there's a link in there for fair use libraries. What does the PIJIP stand for? I should know that.
PIJIP.
Just another good website. So.
Another website. I couldn't tell you.
Oh, here we go. Program on Information Justice and Intellectual Property.
There you go.
That's fantastic. So you mentioned digital natives. In the presentation you had at the Education Summit, I had kind of heard it, but when you said it, I realized it was actually now a thing, right?
Sure.
Can you explain a little bit about that?
So we're talking about digital natives as a specific population, a generation of young people born after 1980 who have grown up in a networked world.
And I almost met the deadline. I'm just kidding. I'm not a digital native. There, I confess.
I want to be.
Right.
And these digital natives have the skills to use rapidly changing digital technologies, and they're really comfortable with processing large amounts of information, which, you know, I really think it's an interesting cutoff point, because, you know, you look at the generation before that, and we're just not quite as comfortable processing large amounts of information. And
I had a Commodore 64. Does anyone remember that? So, yeah. And now my 2-year-old tells me about my iPhone.
That's right.
It's not even an iPhone. I call it an iPhone, but it's whatever the smartphone is, I guess.
A digital native.
He's my digital native. I digress. I apologize. Go ahead.
No, that's great. I mean, it's a perfect example of what that means. And so with these digital natives especially, they're that disconnect between what is happening and what the law says should be happening. It's just a huge gap. Digital natives are learning how to download illegally before they learn that it's illegal. So
right.
There's a real disconnect, because they're growing up believing what they're doing is, or finding out what they're doing is criminal.
They're not really thinking about it. They're not putting it into the context of this is, you know,
because
proprietary
it's so
information
natural.
Or whatever the term is. Yeah.
It's so natural to take information and utilize it or change it a little
Can
bit.
Can you imagine, you know, we had our yellow Cliff Notes books. That was like where we went instead of Google. And can you imagine if you, I don't know how the schools deal with all the, you know, kids with all their, I'll guess I'm going to learn soon enough, but all the, you know, technology and the videos. I mean, all this, the whole trend about bullying came up because all the videos, you know, and that's now, you know, something people are really talking about and getting into, because now all the kids have these videos. I mean,
right.
And then you see those everywhere, or
it's bringing attention,
putting something on YouTube. I mean, I've heard all sorts of things, like, you know, most people say they only put one thing on YouTube and take it to your website, because now you lose the rights once it's on YouTube. I don't know if that's true or not, but those are questions that I don't think younger people who grew up with this technology have thought about.
That's right. Yeah. What are you doing when you put something on YouTube? You're disseminating it to the world. And for example, if you don't have the rights to all of the material you're disseminating, that could be a problem. Another problem that's coming up is somebody put something that actually has original content on YouTube, and these media conglomerates, because of their identification system, which is sort of automatic, they run everything on YouTube through their identification system, and if it flags that there's a copyright violation, they'll actually send you cease and desist. So people are getting cease and desist on their own original work. So it causes a lot of confusion,
right,
around these issues, and the more in-depth information that kids get growing up about this, the more that they can not only make informed choices about what content to use, but they can also be more empowered.
Well, in relating to, you know, our office, we have we've titled kind of this area as emerging media, mm-hmm. In relation to what type of projects are qualifying for the incentive, because we see webisodes, we see interactive commercials. There's a question of when are shorts trailers and when are trailers shorts. I mean, mm-hmm. And then, you know, I think in a panel on Wednesday that I was involved in, there was a mention of a movie shot on an iPod that was entered into the Sundance Film Festival. So, I mean, it's really something that people either have grown up in it or people who are fearful of it need to look at.
Yeah, and our law cannot keep up with these rapidly changing shifts. Our copyright law is so out of date compared to the world around us.
Yeah.
So there has to be something else that kicks in because our law is not following us fast enough.
No, and I find that people within the industries, these industries and kind of on perimeter of these industries, or some have to deal with post-production and some have to deal with this emerging media or digital media, the terminology within the industry isn't consistent. So it's not going to be
consistent
in the law, and then you have to think about, well, what's that definition by the law?
That's right, and one of the things that's really I'm really passionate about is getting more information out there to people about who is in charge of sort of this the education around copyright right now. A lot of it is these media conglomerates who control a lot of rights to a lot of work. And so it's a lot of fear-based, don't do this statements, which is not really education. It's not understanding
right.
the nuances.
It becomes
of
fear,
that
at
is.
Least in my world, but, you know.
And then, you know, sending out cease and desist, which may not actually even be legal cease and desist. And then you're perpetuating this practice of, you know, making people feel like they can't use that work when really they can.
Well, thank you, Talia. It's been great having you on the show. We probably could
talk
forever. So could you just let us know some contact information real quick before we go?
So we are, you can email us at info@nmlawyersforthearts.org or visit us on our website at nmlawyersforthearts.org.
Great. Thank you so much, Talia. You're listening to New Mexico Filmworks. We'll be right back, and this is Talk 1260 KTRC. Listening to New Mexico Filmworks. This is Toby Ives from the New Mexico State Film Office. We just wrapped up with Talia Kosh from the New Mexico Lawyers for the Arts. If you're interested in the panels in which they presented, you can go to the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival.com or nmlawyersforthearts.org. I believe they videotaped all their panels. The film festival runs through the 21st. Also, a little reminder of nmfilm.com. You can see all sorts of bulletin board postings there of announcements, crew calls, casting calls, and, of course, our industry directory that gets you in touch with all the local crew and vendors here in New Mexico. We also have a newsletter. Our first one went out at the end of September, and we're going to have another one going out this week. If you're interested in being on that email distribution list, you can email info@nmfilm.com. Next up, we have a returning guest, Dawn Gray, our contracted locations coordinator. Dawn, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Toby.
So today I thought we'd revisit a little bit about the film office's location services. So, Don, tell us why the online searchable locations database is so important for us.
Well, I think the biggest reason, frankly, is because, you know, these days and for a long time now, Hollywood doesn't always make films where they actually take place in the story. So that's good news and bad news. The good news is that even if your script doesn't take place in New Mexico, we might be able to double where it does actually take place. And so the database with the photos in it, I think the most important thing it does is to convince people that we have more than just the Roadrunner-looking desert in New Mexico.
Though I have to say that that cartoon was inspired by Santa Fe.
Well, we certainly can do that. That's not a problem. But we have lots of other variety, and that's the most important thing, because if we were, you know, if we were only making films in New Mexico that were set in New Mexico, well, there probably wouldn't be very many films to be made.
Right. Yes. And then, of course, our location database gives those looking for locations the ideas of kind of the vast variety of geographical landscapes we have, right?
That's right. And, you know, a variety of different architectural styles. I think most people's perception of New Mexico is based on Santa Fe, which has a very strident southwestern, you know, architectural style. But that's not the only one that exists. So those are important, too.
And I'm wondering if our listeners know that we are the fifth largest state in the country, which means that we have 121,000 square miles, that a lot of which you've covered, Don.
I'd say almost all of it, or certainly a great deal of it, that's for sure.
And Don and I actually looked at the map not too long ago, too, because we were in debate for just how the altitude, the range of altitude here, and it's just under 3,000 feet and goes over 13,000 feet in altitude. I guess I'm big on trivia today. But
I guess so. But
it tells you all the geographical zones, meaning we have a very diverse landscape. So we have about 60,000 photographs of 8,000 locations in our website, and we're always looking for help to update this. So I'm sure listeners who have heard me say this before is that, you know, feel free to look at your communities and let us know what we're representing there.
Right, exactly. If we're all submitting, and you could, there is a, you know, a function on our website where you can submit your property for consideration for film work. It doesn't mean you're agreeing for anything to happen at your home or business or whatever, but it's a good way for us to get it out there in front of people that might be interested in using your location in a film.
And I think one thing that you do a lot after people look at this location, and, you know, because it's such great distances, I mean, you're consulting with a lot of these projects to talk about distance and talk about accessibility and talk about weather. And it's a really great resource. It really helps people understand New Mexico because, like you said, they may only have one perspective of that, you know, maybe Santa Fe, or it may be, you know, the Balloon Fiesta, or one thing that they heard about from someone else. And you know, I know that I've had to tell people, of course we get snow in New Mexico. You know, I'm sure you have too.
Yeah, absolutely. I was talking to a producer from the BBC a couple of days ago, and you know, he was talking about bringing a program here for BBC production, and he came right out and admitted that he thought it was simply blazing hot all year round in New Mexico.
So like the outback in Australia.
Yeah, right? Exactly. So you know, we had to have discussions, and you know, you mentioned the altitude differences, and you know, really, that makes a huge difference in terms of where you are altitude-wise and what time of year, how far north you are. So that's all information that we keep track of at the film office and that we can help people with and help them to understand what they're going to get and when they're going to get it, where they might be interested in shooting.
That's right. And then you often do the location breakdowns. You're sending out photo packages based on that, based on the information you know. You know, we always ask for, you know, the stage of the production, you know, what their shooting schedule is. You know, it helps to have a synopsis even when you do the location breakdown. You know, and obviously this information is confidential. But we pull photographs from our online location database and send these packages out. And people are printing them, and they're sharing them with the director, and they're sharing them with the production designer, and they're determining whether they want to come scout out here.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you can certainly wander around in our database for a long time, and that's certainly an acceptable way to approach it. On the other hand, you know, part of my service at the film office is you could actually give me some parameters to work within, you know, the area that you want to be in or what kind of considerations you would have in terms of weather or special events or things like that, and I can customize a package for your production based on that information.
And, you know, and I find that service really helpful because then you're getting a more efficient and effective scouting itinerary when they do come out here. And they need that because you can't – I remember we had one scout that didn't really want too much involvement with us. He'd call us once in a while, but he really thought he could go from – where was it, like Raton to Las Cruces in one day?
Yeah.
And we want to be able to say, hey, look, we want you to really consider our state, and this is the reality of the distance, and let us help you with this. Because
yeah.
Then all of a sudden they're like, wow, I didn't even know. I didn't even think about that. And here's the location.
Yeah, if you think you can get lost in 60,000 photographs on the database, try just driving around the fifth largest state in the union. See how quickly you get lost.
Absolutely. And I know there's times, depending on our staff resources and, you know, some other various parameters, that we can actually scout with some films. And it's always great when you're able to go out and actually help people while you're on the road, because I know that always changes, and you're stopping and you're going somewhere else. And you never know what's asked or what comes up or how that makes a difference in selling our state. So it's great that we have that ability and that you're able to do that.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
Well, thank you, Don. We always appreciate your speaking with us here in the radio show. You're listening to New Mexico Filmworks. I'm your host, Toby Ives, and I have a few more announcements. But, Don, again, thank you for sharing your thoughts.
Thanks, Toby.
So I'm going to go back to I was talking about our newsletter and our website, and I think we need to revisit that a little bit, because on our website we also have some town halls coming up again, and some of you may remember we did these last year as well. Next week we're going to be on Clovis the 24th and in Carlsbad the 25th, and actually, I might have flipped those, so you're going to have to go to the website, get the information. It's nmfilm.com. I think it was in a press release there. You'll see a press release in the top corner there. Again, thank you for joining our show. This is New Mexico Filmworks. I'm Toby from the New Mexico State Film Office, and you're listening to Talk 1260 KTRC.